Well, good morning, Sunridge. My name is Greg. I'm one of the pastors here. And if you're a guest, we're glad that you're here. I would like to also extend happy Mother's Day wishes to all of you. It happens to be my second Mother's Day without my mom, and my wife's first Mother's Day without her mom. Big day for us. And then we have one of our daughters. We have three. One of them, it's her first Mother's Day. So I'm happy to be calling them later and talking to them about that. So we've been in a series on David, call it Renaissance, David Renaissance Man. And in part, this series is designed to speak to men. We're going to continue that today. David was a compassionate shepherd. David was a strategic warrior, and David was a beloved king. He also wrote much of the book of Psalms, if you didn't know, some of the most real, raw, and beautiful poetry in all the world. David was a man of severe contrasts. He was single-mindedly committed to God, yet guilty of some of the most serious sins that were recorded in the Old Testament. One biographer of David said it this way: he's somewhat like a painting with the dominant colors of white and black and gold. In many details, David left us with an example to follow. In other places, he left us with a warning to heed. And still in another place, he's featured as a type of Jesus to come. We're going to look at that today. Our mission statement as a church is to help people find and follow Jesus. So the focus of this series on the life of David is to help us to find and follow Jesus through studying the life of David. And today we're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 17. If you have a worship center Bible, it's about halfway through as you get to the Psalms. And then about a quarter way to the left, you should find yourself very near to 1 Samuel. We're going to be in chapter 17. And this story of David and Goliath that we're going to look at today is often taught in churches or Sunday school. No doubt almost everybody, if not everybody in the room, has heard this story. But it's often taught in a moralistic or legalistic way. I would equate legalism with moralism. I would see those as synonyms. And something like this is oftentimes the message of the story, the narrative of David and Goliath. Be like David and be brave. Sometimes we come away with that sense of having been taught that. You've heard this statement that the bigger they are, the harder they fall. That's sometimes the lesson from the life, the story, the narrative of David and Goliath. I heard, listened to a few moments, one of the largest churches in America, the pastor said this, the main point of the story of David and Goliath: some things are worth fighting for. That's what he pulled out of the story. Now, all those things are true things, but I would say to you, that's not the point of the story. So we're going to try and look at that today and see what we can find. David and Goliath, it's a narrative about a profile of three kings or three champions. There's a third one that we'll add into the mix today. And each one of those dealt with their own fear in this situation, the narrative that we will read. And so I want to take the time to read 1 Samuel. I'm going to read a little bit here. And again, it's on page 197. I'm going to read 17, 1 through 11. And I'm going to skip down to 32 and read to 51. That's a lot of verses, so I hope you hang in there with me. There's a lot of little nuance in here that I want us to see and to refer back to. So 1 Samuel 17, starting in verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Sekah in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes-Damon and between Sukkah and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines were a seafaring group from Crete originally. And the Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites the other, and the valley in between. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits. That equates to 9 feet and a span. And he had a bronze helmet, and on his head he wore a coat of scale armor, picture a snake, bronze, weighing 5,000 shekels. That's about 125 pounds. Can you imagine that? And on his legs he wore bronze greaves. Those are shin guards. And a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's beam or rod, and its iron point weighed 600 shekels. That's like 30 pounds. I was at the gym last night. I had a 10-pound dumbbell. I don't think I could throw that thing 10 feet, let alone a spear with a weaver's beam with a 30-pound point. That's amazing. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood, verse 8, and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me, and if he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man. Let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And skipping to verse 32, David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." And Saul replied, "You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior since his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it and struck it and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it." He's a stud, man. Your servant, he's about 15 years old. Okay, I lost my place. Sorry, I shouldn't look up. I went after, struck it, and rescued from its mouth. When it turned, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defiled the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said to David, "Go then, and God be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic, that's the undergarment, and put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around. Picture that, just for because he was not used to them. He said, "I can't go in these." He said to Saul, "Because I'm not used to them." He took them off, and he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, and put them in the pouch of the shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." And David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with a sword and spear and javelin, and I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands. I'll strike you down, cut off your head this very day. I will give you the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." And the Philistine moved closer to attack. David ran quickly to the battle line to meet him, reaching into his bag, taking out a stone. He slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. I'll just stop and mention the research shows that the slingers were part of the regular army. This was not, it was something that happened. Right? And at this distance, they think that the stone hit Goliath in the forehead with the same velocity as a .45 caliber bullet when it struck his forehead. These slingers in the arm, they could pick off a bird in midair. They could hit a target 200 yards away. So this is something that we'll consider. Verse 50, we're almost done. So David triumphed over the Philistine with the sling and the stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. And David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from his sheath, and he killed him, and he cut off his head with the sword. Happy Mother's Day. I'm going to pray, and then we'll jump in. Father, thank you for this time. We welcome and honor your presence amongst us, and I pray that we would see some new things about ourselves and about you in this sermon today. So we commit this time to you and pray in Jesus' name. Amen. So this narrative provides us with a profile of three kings or champions and how they each dealt with fear in this situation. Two quick points before we jump into that. Number one, the Hebrew word for champion that is ascribed to Goliath in verses 4 and 23 literally means the man in between, the man in between. Not so much a warrior, not so much a combatant, but a representative. That's what this word is talking about. One who fights on behalf of others. A champion bears the weight of victories. He also bears the weight of losses. In battle, when the champion wins, everybody wins, and when the champion loses, everybody loses. To better understand this representative concept, consider the World Cup soccer championships that are to be held in Brazil in about a month. See, if the American team, the USA team, wins, we all win. And if the USA team loses, we all will lose. So that's the representative battle. By the way, there's not much chance. I think the odds makers say it's 125 to 1 that the USA team will win. But that makes it a good underdog battle, so we can hope for the best. So let's look at our text, number two. Let's look at our text to help us define fear and courage. And David, this young 15-year-old about shepherd boy, he gets to the real issue. Look at verse 32 when he says, "Let no man's heart fall on account of Goliath's taunting." The literal translation would be, "Let no one's heart fail." Let no one's heart fail. Fear is when our heart fails. Fear is when our heart retreats or wilts. Or falters. So then true courage is when a heart stands fast regarding what is right, what is true. When a heart stands fast regarding what is compassionate, what is just, what is merciful, even when it's threatened by danger. It doesn't mean that our heart will beat any slower in those moments of fear. Fear is like an indicator light on the dashboard of a car. It awakens our attention. It tells us that we need to pay attention. But a fearful heart falls versus understanding what's going on and facing our fear. We'll learn hopefully more about that. These are things that we're exposed to every day. Yesterday morning, I got up a little bit early and was considering the text and the message, and when Linda got up, I asked her two questions. I asked Linda, my wife, I asked, where am I courageous and where am I a coward? And she had the gall to, like, answer me. What's that about, you know? I guess I wanted her to answer me, but I wanted her to say, well, let me think about that, but she answers so quickly. It's like she's been waiting for years to tell me this. And so she told me two things, my wife is wise. She's good at this. She told me two things that I was courageous in, and one thing, she didn't use the word coward. She said you could be more courageous. Get it? Now, that's a hint. That's a good way to go, isn't it? So anyway, I'm gonna assign you some homework today. I did this, and now I want you to do this. Here's some questions that I want you to ask yourself and maybe have a conversation on the way home or maybe later in the week. Number one, how does the Bible address fear? Good question. Number two, how do we manage fear and live authentically with inevitable fears. Like I said, fear is going to come. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. Fears like failure, rejection, exposure, loss of control, the need for approval or recognition. Some of us have fears of alienation. Some of us have fears of irrelevance. I'd also like to ask you to ask yourself, where am I courageous and where am I a coward? And to take it a step further, consider having a conversation with someone who's not afraid to be honest with you and ask them that question too. Where am I courageous and where am I a coward? And again, we can all learn from my wife in that regard, how we say those things. This morning, I'd like to look at three things. Number one, the faltering courage of the reigning king. That would be Saul. Number two, the false courage of the rival king. That would be Goliath. And number three, the focused courage of the soon-to-be king. Of course, that would be David. And we'll consider them one at a time. So we'll start with number one, the faltering courage of the reigning king or champion. Look at verse 3. The Philistines, it says, occupied one hill and the Israelites another with the valley in between them. Now see these two camps on these hills and the valley. In Psalm 23, where it says, "Oh, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." This gives us some insight. A lot of the battles that took place in the valley. You have two camps up on the hill and there's kind of a standoff, right? They're waiting for the other one to make the move. Because you can't just leave your encampment and go down the valley and go up because you're completely exposed. So they're just hanging out waiting for each other, waiting on each other. And the Philistines sought to employ an ancient warfare tactic called single combat. It's a little bit comparable to a duel. Another way it's described in history is champion warfare. And what that is, it's considered a more humane way of settling a dispute or a conflict without major bloodshed. This actually happened more often than we realized. So they're at this standoff on these two hills, and then Goliath comes down, and he makes his way down into the valley, and he calls Saul out. And by all accounts in the Bible, Saul is a very impressive guy. 1 Samuel 9 gives us some backstory on Saul. He was a man of great wealth. He was a man of great breeding. He was the most handsome man in Israel, the Bible tells. He was also the tallest man in Israel, which is why it's easy to think that when Goliath came down, what he's really doing is calling out Saul. He's a very competent soldier. He's ambitious. He's determined. He is the ideal of what every king should be. Every Disney story we've ever seen, Saul is your guy when it comes to being king. Everything Israel ever wanted in a king, his chief responsibility as the king was to be Israel's champion. That was his job, their protector, defender, to lead Israel into battle. But verse 11 tells us, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. I can just picture that. Have you ever been in a room with a leader and something happens? You can see all the people when, say, Goliath comes down. And his booming voice, I doubt he had a high-pitched voice, like, "Hey, everybody." Yeah, I don't think it was that, right? But this booming voice comes out of Goliath, and he calls Saul out. Can you see all the Israelite army looking at Saul? That's where everybody's face. How's he doing? What's going on here? He's the tallest guy here. He must be the guy. And when they saw that Saul was afraid, then, of course, they became afraid. Saul's heart fell. He was afraid. His courage wilted and faltered. True courage is not about physical prowess. It's not about competence. It's about the capacity to do what is right even when there are consequences involved, even when our own heart, our own life is threatened. Here's an everyday example. I want to speak to married men and married men and fathers. I thought about this. What is the most courageous thing a married man and a father can do? I'd like to give you my perspective from having studied the Bible for a few years now. When we get home after work, a courageous husband will take the time to inquire after the soul and after the heart of his wife. And then he will take the time to inquire after the soul and after the heart of his children. You might be thinking, well, I'm really tired. I've been on 14, you don't understand, I'm gone 14 hours a day. That's what courageous husbands and fathers do. Our wives and our kids need that kind of consistency, no matter what kind of day you had. That as you're driving up to the driveway, that you pray that prayer. How can I be a servant to my wife and my children today? In these moments before they go to bed, coming and taking the kids from mom, playing with the kids, listening. How is their heart? How is their soul? How can I serve them today? It's easier to grab a beverage, flip on the TV, or get in a computer, or go to a man cave, pick up the paper. I think it's actually cowardly to place our emotional comfort over the emotional comfort, and spiritual, the physical comfort of our family. So that's an everyday occurrence for a lot of us where our heart can fall or our heart can stand fast. And that leads us to number two, the false courage of the rival king or champion. This is Goliath, and he's not only a counterpoint to David, he's also a counterpoint to Saul. Saul has faltering courage, but Goliath has misplaced, unfounded, or false courage, as we'll see in a moment. The text, as I said, says he's 9 feet tall. Malcolm Gladwell, in his book, David and Goliath, his research indicated that Goliath was about 6 feet, 9 inches tall. So he's somewhere between 6'9 and 9 feet. The average height of men in that day was about 5 feet. So either way, he's a lot taller and more imposing. We have a very detailed description of Saul's armor in this passage. And that's not normal for Hebrew narrative. Hebrew narrative generally is very sparse in its description, but the author seems to go overboard in describing Goliath's armor. He reveals he is totally teched out, the latest military technology, and again, 125 pounds of armor, and a spear with a point on it that weighs 30 pounds. Think of an ancient Near Eastern transformer. That's what they saw when they were looking at Goliath down the road there, down in the valley. What we can learn from the text is that while Goliath was certainly a very, very formidable opponent, he was also quite fearful. How do we know this? While Saul falters in his courage, Goliath is attempting to manufacture or engineer his courage. Here's 2 points I'd like to make. He minimizes the reality of the situation through mockery or cynicism or sarcasm. Have you ever been around somebody that when they get intimidated, they lash out verbally through mockery and cynicism and sarcasm? It's been an ongoing issue in our family. My wife doesn't think that sarcasm is a legitimate form of humor. And I come from this very sarcastic family, so that's something that we always kind of wrestle with as we move forward. Our kids, 4 kids, they're a little sarcastic. I think they're the best of both worlds. That's how I'm saying it. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, really. But we, God forbid you are that person, but we know of people who, when they get intimidated or fearful, that they lash out verbally. This is what Goliath is doing here. He minimizes the reality of the situation through mockery. He's saying, I will deal with my fear by attempting to intimidate my opponents, which is exactly what he was doing to David. He's nothing but a bully with false bravado. The second thing that he did, he overcompensates in an attempt to overcome his fears through all the latest technology. He over-armors himself, is what he does. Goliath is saying, I will deal with my fear by minimizing the danger through mockery and maximizing my position through all this armor that I'm wearing. And Goliath is clearly out of touch with reality. He has actually failed to assess the danger, and for this reason, he's defeated. He should have known. He should have known. Slingers were part of the army. All he had was false bravado in the end. Saul maximized his fear by giving up his armor, and his heart fell. Goliath minimized his fears with false bravado. But David, he faced his fears. And that brings us to number three, the focused courage of the soon-to-be king or champion. These three men each deal with their fear in the same way they dealt with their armor. Saul gives up his armor, surrendering his courage, and his heart falls. Then there's Goliath. He puts on too much armor, and he minimizes his own fears. He minimizes the real threat of the moment. He gets taken out. His heart falls, but it falls face down. And then there's David. You see, both Saul and Goliath were fundamentally trusting in themselves. They were fundamentally trusting in their own armor. And David was different. While David acknowledges the very real fear, the very real danger of the situation, yet he continues. And notice in verse 48, he even runs to the battle line. I want to acknowledge that there's probably many people in this room right now that have been in this kind of battle line, in this kind of battle. And I want to say thank you for defending your country on our behalf. And you know what it's like to run to the battle line, or at least to be at the battle line and in great danger. And I'd also like to say, in a couple of weeks on Memorial Day, we're having a service where we're going to honor veterans. So I hope you'll come. I hope you'll invite your veteran friends and acquaintances to join us. We want to say thank you to them. So David sees Goliath's size, and he measures it not against a human standard, but he measures it against his growing understanding of a very, very big God. What is true courage, and where does it come from? David understands in verse 47, 1 Samuel 17:47, the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's. David understood that in a way that Saul did not, in a way that Goliath did not. Saul was a faltering champion. Goliath was a false champion, but David, the son of Jesse, born in Bethlehem, who fights in spite of his fear, he is a very focused champion. What is he focused on? Well, he's a shepherd king who, even if he dies, is willing to trust in God. David, instead of going in with his armor, his sword, his shield, or in modern vernacular, with guns blazing, he goes in faith as a shepherd, as a servant, trusting God in his own weakness. Does that remind you of anybody? Jesus is the second and the greater David. David actually shows us the story of Jesus. Jesus' heart never fell. Jesus is our true champion. Jesus is the man in between who goes into the valley and defeats the greatest giant there ever was, the giant of sin and death. Why? So that when you and I experience fear, it's inevitable. Remember, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. When you and I experience fear, our heart need not fail. Are you deathly afraid of losing control? Jesus gave up his control. Are you deathly afraid of humiliation? Jesus experienced a greater humiliation. If you're deathly afraid of embarrassment or disapproval or discomfort, Jesus experienced all of that and more. We can remember that his victory is our victory. His exaltation is our exaltation. His affirmation becomes our affirmation. So that when our hearts begin to fall or they begin to stumble, we realize that we have in Jesus a true champion. Here's the punchline. I can't say to you, be like David. You know why? Because I'll speak in the I. I'm more like the cowering Israelites who are afraid of the giant. That's who I am. I need a champion. I can't get there from here. So this narrative is not saying to us, be like David, be brave. It's saying, understand that your true self is more like the cowering Israelites who were deathly afraid. And in our case, the giant is sin and death. Remember, we've said that even to miss the mark regarding sin, sin means miss the mark. Even to miss the mark by a little bit means that you've missed. And I like what David, you know, David picked up 5 stones, right? He didn't just pick up 1. He picked 5. He's like, I might miss. But he didn't. Here's what I'm saying. We can't. We are not. And I'll say it. You are not like David. We need a champion. David slings the rock and crushed the enemy's head. If you were with us a few weeks ago, we talked about the first gospel presentation in the Bible. It goes back to Genesis 3:15, and where God curses the serpent, the devil, Satan. And he says, the seed of the woman will crush your head. And this is a foretaste of that promise. We don't fight for victory in the Christian life. Here's the difference. We fight from victory. And to see that little change, we don't fight for, we fight from. It's his victory. He's won it. And for us to have that perspective, for us to begin to understand and to read and see that the Bible is about the victory that Jesus earned. That David's life shows us Jesus. That's its intention. It's all grace. That's been our overriding theme here at Sunridge for the last 10 months. It's all grace. And that reminded me, I'll close with this. John Newton in his hymn, Amazing Grace, one of the verses says, 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear. And fear in this context, of course, means worship, reverence, adoration. So he says, 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. You have fears, I have fears. The only way to see those fears relieved is through trusting in the grace of God. And I encourage you to step up to that today. I'll pray as we close.